I think it started off with me feeling misunderstood maybe in high school. And, you know, we all kind of go through that.
This is Susanna Ozeta, who grew up in Kansas City's historic Northeast neighborhood.
I got into a lot of trouble, I'm going to be honest. But then I was like, okay, what led to this? And a lot of it had to do with some of my teachers or my education.
What did Susanna do with this realization? She decided to become, of all things, a teacher.
I want to be in my city, and I want to be in my neighborhood where I grew up and give back to those kids. I'm excited about the fact that they can see themselves in me. Their eyes lit up when they knew I was from the neighborhood. And when I talk about going to places in the neighborhood, they're kind of like, oh, you're from here, you know? And they ask me questions all the time, like, so do you know where, like, St. John is? You know, do you sit on your porch sometimes? Like, you know, like things that they do in their neighborhood, they want to know if I do them too. I'm like, yeah, you know, I do.
Now, kids are always surprised to learn that their teachers have lives outside the classroom, that they do normal stuff like sitting on porches. But part of what comes as a surprise to Susanna's students is that she is like them. She comes from their community. A lot of the time, teachers in urban environments come from someplace else and have a totally different frame of reference for what life is like after the bell rings at the end of the day. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're exploring how urban environments shape education. And we'll start by examining what we mean when we use that term, urban. Usiel Pessina, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks for being here. You're coming to us from UMKC's Division of Educational Leadership, Policy, and Foundations. You've just taught a summer course for the school's Institute of Urban Education, where future teachers get 4 years of training tailored to prepare them for urban classrooms. Your summer course included, among other things, trips to a juvenile correctional facility. Tell me about that summer course.
The summer course was designed by one of my mentors, Dr. Valerie Blackwell. But it was in collaboration with the entire school, the unit mission to engage or have students engage within the communities that are going to be serving in the future. And so what we've done is provided them an entire summer course prior to their student teaching year, opportunities to get into community agencies, a variety of community agencies throughout the metro area to gain those greater experiences within the communities eventually they're going to serve.
What kind of agencies do they go into?
Oh, we're talking community service agencies, traditional community service agencies, group homes, hospital types of agencies, clinics, but we try to always pair them up where they will have access to children and families.
Why take teachers who will be working in classrooms and not prisons or hospitals or group homes to these places? How does that train them?
It gives them the opportunity to meet parents one-on-one, students one-on-one, community members who are already engaged in those communities, to gather resources, information, contacts, networks that they at some point may use in their profession, in their young lives, as they become that middle-level teacher, as they become the master teacher, to be that contact for that particular agency or agencies as needed by their particular schools or students.
How do you define the word urban in the context of education? Is that kind of a euphemism?
Yes. It's all based upon the density of population. Every single community, all the communities, both urban, inner city, suburban, and rural, we all have the same issues. It just seems to be a little more concentrated when we're in the inner city and a more urban area, needing more skills and having better access to networks and safety nets for families and children.
What percentage of students in that Institute of Urban Education? I mean, I know you don't work for the Institute, but you work alongside it with a lot of the same goals. Do you know what percentage of students come from urban environments themselves who want to be teachers?
Not absolutely sure, but you do have students in the IUE who are committed to the metro area as well as the inner city schools, and that is their commitment. They know they want to serve within that inner city area.
What tends to motivate them in that?
Well, many of them do come from our communities, or for some reason or another have had contacts with urban communities or inner city communities, and they have made that decision early on in their high school career that they want to serve and within that population.
So this program trains teachers through experience in urban classrooms and site visits exploring urban neighborhoods. In the 10 years the Institute of Urban Education has existed, more than 90% of the graduates teaching in Kansas City, Missouri, Hickman Mills, and KCK have remained in the classroom. That is a much higher retention rate for new teachers than urban districts typically see. Why do you think that is?
I think it's amazing. It is the greater exposure that they have early on in their college career and their preparation. They come out more confident. They come out vigorous. They come out ready and with a satchel full backpack full of ideas and also the connections they've had with particular schools and school districts. They've built that confidence over that time. And so when they graduate,
they've
after
had
four years, they're not coming out a brand new, semester experienced teacher like I did back in 91. They have 4 years and a full year of teaching experience with a co-teacher. They feel very confident in their first year, which really would probably equate to their second or third year of teaching.
And they make a pretty serious commitment before they even get started. I mean, they commit to 4 years in the program itself and then 4 years that they will remain in the classroom, that they, won't give up, basically,
right,
when they encounter difficult situations.
Right. And through those connections, and the mentorship. And the mentorship that they receive and continue to receive through UMKC, they tend to stay, and they tend to stay within the communities they serve, and that's a good thing. They then now can move into leadership positions, and I'm proud to say that I've already had 3 to 4 IUE graduates within our leadership within our program and I will say they are some of the most dedicated folk that I've been able to teach.
Understand why you would want to train teachers in a way that prepares them not for generic students, but for the specific reinforcing stereotypes about urban kids. A part of me, I have to admit, did feel a little squeamish about assumptions about urban youth and crime, but maybe that's just incredibly naive on my part.
Well, the thing is that you will continue with your assumptions and your prejudices until you experience a place to visit, a place where we don't want our students to wind up. But unfortunately, it does happen to a few. At the lowest point of children there at the facility in their 5 to 10 year experience.
So it's not the idea that it's a possibility and a possibility to avoid.
And a possibility to avoid is to keep them out of there and know that we can still be in touch with a facility like that in the continuing education that we can provide from, a school building. Just keeping in contact with our students and making sure they're still receiving the education or any challenges.
Let's get a parent's perspective. Jamika Kendricks has 2 kids in the Kansas City, Missouri School District. She's a parent leader in the district, and she's also a social worker who works with at-risk teens. Hi, Jamika.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. What does it feel like to you as a parent with 2 kids in the Kansas City, Missouri School District to hear how we've been talking about urban education so far?
About the teachers who are prepared and them choosing to stay on and why they choose to become a part of one of the things that I think about when it comes to teachers and when we're talking about finding from the neighborhoods or the communities, it's really difficult, especially when you look at Kansas City Public Schools, by most standards, not been providing adequate education. The problem would be that for generations, we've been not providing that education in the grade. So we're not actually preparing those students who live within the communities to come out and come to programs so that they can come back and teach. So I think it's not just an issue of can we find those teachers beginning in high school to be able to graduate from those programs, but then
beginning before it's not really an option.
Right. and then the other thing that I was thinking of when we're talking about exposure for teachers to students in a correctional facility was really great. Because I spent a year working as a counselor in juvenile detention, and it was one of my favorite jobs. But I tell people all the time, the students who were residents of the detention center were some of the most amazing leaders I have ever met in my life.
Leaders in what sense?
A lot of times, and I'm one, I recognize it, a lot of times there are children who kind of question them. And in classrooms today, with the focus on testing and whatnot, bucking the system is not allowed. And so a lot of times students are referred to behavioral or to special needs classes or put out of the classroom or suspended because of behavior issues because they question authority. I graduated from Pembroke Hill, and one of the things for ourselves and to question authority.
And that's a private school in Kansas City, Missouri.
Yes, I'm sorry.
No,
I think that there's a difference in the education. And so for the students in regular public schools that do the same things that are encouraged in a private school, they get labeled as behavior issues, or they get labeled as bad students or students with without a bright future and placed into detention. And these are so smart and have so much potential, but it's hard to see that because there's like this push and pull with authority.
Yeah, that is super interesting, the discipline piece of it. A recent study sent out by KU's news service shows that Black students with Black teachers have a more positive perception of fairness in the classroom. And I wonder if that is connected to what you are describing.
I believe it is. I always say I love working with the at-risk kids. I remember it like when I first who dresses up. I was told there's a dress code. You have to look professional. And so I had to dress up. And so all of the kids in the detention center thought I came from Overland Park or somewhere. And so they were not trying to connect with me. And then I got put in charge of the drug class that all students who had any kind of infraction related to drugs had to go through. And they started to find out, well, she grew up where we did. She understands what it is that we're dealing with. And so I think that
and she has credibility.
Yes, it made a huge difference. And a lot of times they say that I'm more like a mom, but I do see them that way because they look just like my kids. They are who I was. And I always say I do this work because I'm looking out for future Jamaicas and trying to make sure that I do what I can so that they don't have to deal with the same issues that I've had to deal with. And those future Jamaicas are most likely in detention.
Well, why? I'm curious about why future Jamaicas need help. I mean, why they need guidance, and like, what is it that you've been through that gives you that perspective?
So my background, my mom has six children. We all ended up graduating from Pembroke Hill. When I first started attending Pembroke Hill, my mother was actually receiving public assistance and we were on scholarships, my brother and I. My dad is a recovering drug addict alcoholic. I found out that he had a problem with drugs when we had a family meeting and I was 8 years old, and we were being told that he was going into either a 30 or 90 day treatment facility. And so that was a struggle. But then I say a lot of times, like with the children with behavior issues, it's kind of like you get that stomped out of you through school or in your families. And I think people are well-intentioned and they're trying to make sure you don't end up in jail. but that what I call defiance is oftentimes a positive thing that, again, is looked at negatively. And so like your spark and your dreams, those kind of things sometimes get snuffed out unintentionally by people who are well-meaning.
When did you start at Pembroke Hill? I mean, how old were you and what years are we talking about?
I started at Pembroke Hill in seventh grade. And in seventh grade, I don't remember exactly how old I was.
That's okay. But can you talk about the transition from whatever school you had attended before to Pembroke Hill? I mean, kind of set up what one school was like and then how the other was either similar or different. I'm guessing different, but
that was rough. And actually, when you asked that question, I thought about an experience I had. I attended Border Star for elementary school. One of my most dynamic teachers, Mr. Kyle, was my fourth and fifth grade teacher in that school. And I remember that there were two white girls in the school, and one of them used to get beat up at lunchtime every day simply because she was white and quiet. And we were mean. I didn't beat her up, but I did watch and not say anything, which is basically the same as contributing. But so she had that experience in a public school where most of the students were Black. And when I went to Pembroke Hill, I had that same experience, only I was a Black student where the majority of the students were white. And I always tell people about one experience that describes, for me, I hated school from 7th to 11th grade because of my experience at Pembroke. And there's one experience that kind of sums up the classism and racism I experienced that kind of shocked me. And so I was in 7th grade in Spanish class. We had a native Spanish speaker. She was from Costa Rica. We were having a discussion for some reason about public school versus private school. And it flipped into Black versus white as far as ability to learn. And I'm the only Black student in the class, so I begin to speak up. And one of the students said, well, we don't care what you think, because all black people are monkeys with pubic hair growing off their heads. And so I got upset, and I know I raised my voice. I wasn't, like, yelling.
That is a pretty unbelievable thing for someone to say.
Right? And I'm in the 7th grade, and I'm the only Black student in this class, and so I had a normal 7th grader reaction. And so the teacher told me that I needed to be quiet or she would call security, and so I was escorted out and up to the principal's office. And the principal at the time told me that I would get detention, and I think I had detention for a month at the time, and the student who made the comment to me wouldn't get any punishment because his family had contributed a lot of money to the school. And so it was kind of all that in one, and it sums up a lot of the experiences that made me hate school.
This is a lot of issues all in one: class, yes. Race,
social justice.
A lot of things.
Yes.
Yeah. I should probably acknowledge that I went to that school as well, and I don't okay. think we were there at the same time. But I
graduated in 97.
Yeah, we were. Oh, you were just a couple years younger than me, so okay. we didn't meet then. But yeah, I'm sorry that happened to you. And it's interesting because I remember students coming from different backgrounds and having all kinds of adjustments. I mean, that is an incredible story that, you know, I'm glad I didn't witness anything like that. But I do remember students coming from different backgrounds, you know, getting papers marked up, having come from schools where the preparation might not have been the same, and not feeling like they necessarily had the support to play catch up and things like that. Did you feel any of those things?
No. I think this is a tribute to great teachers and Kansas City Public Schools all in one. I went to Kansas City Public Schools again through 6th grade, Border Star before it was Montessori, from 3rd to 5th, and then Lincoln in 6th grade. And in order to get into Pembroke, we had to take an entrance exam. My brother went the same year as me, but he was in 9th grade. When we took that exam, neither of us scored below 95% on any one part of that exam. My brother got 99 plus in math, which means he was perfect, but they didn't want to tell him that. Even though we scored that highly on this exam, the school still suggested to my mom that she hold us back a grade, and she chose not to. And I was actually on honor roll my first semester at Pembroke Hill.
You know, the story that you told earlier brings up the point that, I mean, what was the background of the teacher in that classroom setting, if you don't mind me asking?
She was from Costa Rica. She wasn't from here. She was a native speaker and had grown up there.
Did the teacher have any kind of response to what the kids were doing and saying before you reacted?
I don't remember, honestly. But I'm assuming because of her reaction to me, she was somewhat supportive of what it was that they had to say. What I remember is what happened in that moment and being taken out of the classroom, because I think we remember trauma better than anything else, and that was the traumatic point for me.
Usiel Pacina, what do you hear in that story? I mean, is it significant that the teacher wasn't from the same background as Jamaica? And maybe...
No, I'm not surprised. I mean, it's something that I teach the undergraduates and, you know, the future administrators, that just because we come from ethnic backgrounds, different communities, doesn't mean that we know everything about, you know, different communities, period. I mean, it's just the lack of exposure, lack of experiences, conflict resolution, ability to de-escalate situations, knowing your students, knowing where they come from. and knowing the situations where a teacher can be more facilitator rather than someone who is just going to just shut the door and not even have it as a teachable moment. But those are skills that teachers have to learn regardless of wherever you come from.
Technically, Pembroke Hill is an urban school. It's in the city limits of Kansas City, Missouri, but I don't think it's what we're talking about when we talk about urban education. And Jamika, I wonder if you can take a stab at defining urban education.
Well, when urban education is discussed, it's usually referring to urban areas are areas where there's a lot of low-income families and people of color. Generally, that's what I see when we talk about urban. And to use an example, there were some folks who said that they would stop going to Westport because it had become too urban. And basically, there were too many people of color showing up who didn't look like the other people who were generally patronizing Westport. And they decided we need to shift down to the Plaza because it's too urban.
You don't know where I graduated from in 1986, do you?
No.
Westport High School.
Okay.
So.
Was it urban then?
Sure. And that was celebrated. I mean, we were a very mixed school. And that was something that we celebrated. We still had students coming in from, foreign exchange students coming in. And we thought it was celebrated. I mean, it wasn't perfect. But that's what the world is all about.
Is mixing it up?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting. Less than 7% of Missouri teachers right now are minorities. And there are efforts to recruit more minority teachers, but it seems to be just incredibly challenging. And we've heard a little bit about why that might be. But Usiel Pessina, I wonder if you'd pick up on that.
One of the challenges is you can't be what you don't see. I mean, we understand that. But I'm one who's not going to advocate just putting in someone of color just to put them in there to be a teacher. It has to be a competent, caring, sensitive, empathetic person who knows and has the skill to be a great teacher. And we have to find those wonderful folk, and sometimes we have to foster them. And through explorer clubs in high school, but just find those wonderful folk who are willing to take on that challenge.
Hold that thought. When Central Standard returns, we'd love to hear your story. When you were a kid, did your teachers understand where you were coming from? And how did that affect your education? If you have a perspective that tends to be left out of conversations like this, now's your chance to share it. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute.
Best way to teach anyone, you have to know who they are and create that relationship. If you work within the community, you're creating that foundation or that relationship to where they'll trust you to the point where you can actually teach them something.
That was Jared Bell. He's just starting his fourth year as a teacher in training at the Institute of Urban Education at UMKC. As part of KCUR's Teaching It Forward series, today's Central Standard is exploring how students, teachers, and parents relate to one another in urban schools. Our guests are Usiel Pessina from UMKC and Jamika Kendricks, a parent with two kids in the Kansas City, Missouri School District. She's also a social worker who serves at-risk teens. Call in to share your story at 816-235-2888. When you were a kid, did your teachers get your life outside the classroom? How did that understanding or lack thereof affect your education. 816-235-2888. Usiel and Jamika, it seems like there could be a slippery slope between being aware of challenges kids face and working to accommodate those realities to lowering expectations and possibly holding kids back. Do you think it's right to adjust expectations in different school environments? I'll start with you, Usiel.
I think that's what a teacher should be aware of, is understanding that one has to make adjustments as they guide their students, as they facilitate their learning. But you're not going to know that until you know your students and have built a relationship with them early on. Many times we only have 9 months with them. If we're lucky, they're in a setting where it's a K-8, which you get to know the family much better. And, you know, the children that wind up going through that experience, it is those transient students, unfortunately, who we often lose that communication, that connection with. And that is inconsistent.
I think people who live in my community, and I live on 33rd and Benton, like the heart of the urban core right now, are some of the most resilient, resourceful people I've ever met in my life. I mean, they can make some amazing things with nothing. And I think having an understanding of that is important. But I think oftentimes what happens when we expose people who haven't experienced it to these realities, the things that are actually what I would say things that really help me to be who I am are often considered as deficits or looked at as problems. And then people feel sorry for you because they haven't had to experience it. And so instead of telling you, I don't want to hear the excuses because I believe you're capable and I understand where you're coming from. People are saying, well, you have this problem. Let me work on this problem because you probably can't learn anything until we deal with that. And then after we deal with that, we're going to teach. And I think part of the reason that the kids I work with love me is I don't accept the excuses. And if they come to me and say, well, my dad just went to jail. Okay, so what are we going to do about that? My dad was a crackhead. And I will literally say it like that because they make fun of crackheads and this is how they feel. And I'm like, my dad had this issue, but who my dad is helped to create who I am. And I thank my dad for all of the mistakes he's made, plus all of the positive things he's done, because I wouldn't be Jamaica and I wouldn't be able to do the work that I do were it not for that. So I think we have to look at it differently. Having a parent addicted to drugs is not necessarily a deficit that I have to overcome to learn. It may be something that's actually helping me to be a better learner when framed differently.
You know, you have been to both public and private schools, and your kids are in public schools. You mentioned some of the differences in terms of how people talk about education in those two different environments, like that thinking for yourself in a private school was treated as this great thing, and that in the public school it was a sort of discipline liability. And I wonder if there are other differences in terms of how people talk about education and whether we need to think really hard about those.
I do. I would say one of the things that I focused on in the last probably 3 or 4 years is the message that we're given as far as education is concerned. In public school, I always got the message that education was my way out. In private school, I was given the message that education was a key to success. And they sound similar, but they're very different.
Flesh out that difference.
The key to success assumes that the people around me are successful, and I want to be successful like them. Education is your way out assumes that the people around me are unsuccessful and that I want to get away from them and separate myself from them. One of the things my husband pointed out when we were watching the movie about NWA, forget the name of it.
Straight Outta Compton.
There we go. Straight Outta Compton.
In stereo.
When we were watching that, they told Eazy-E he was exceptional. And then he was like on a downward spiral to think that he was great after that. And that is a message that is often given to students who are dealing with their obstacles in a positive way and still able to learn. And so we're told we're exceptional, which means we're better than the people around us. And for me, I think that contributes to the fact that it's not that in my community or in Kansas City public schools, we haven't produced lawyers or doctors or business owners or teachers. It's that those people are given the message to move away. And so those that we produce move somewhere else and they contribute to those communities and say, well, I can't go back there and I can't raise my kids there because it's a bad place, because they've been taught that, but not because it is a bad place. Otherwise, they wouldn't be who they are.
Lucille, I see you reacting, but I want to know what's happening in your mind right now?
Well, the thing is that you have, as I was telling some folk outside in the green room, I am a product of the district. All of my brothers and sisters graduated from the district. I have 4 kids that have gone, that are in the district. One that graduated from Lincoln. My wife, who grew up in parochial schools. When we were deciding where to send our children, we both decided that the best, most global experience our children would get would be in public schools. And we chose not to leave. I live 13 blocks away from my childhood home. I grew up on the west side, 21st Street, and I live on 34th in Coleman Road. But we purposely made that decision. Now our siblings have moved out, but you know, it's their decision, and we need people of color out there too, you know, and that's okay, and I'm okay with that. But we purposely decided to be a part of the solution, and I will give props to Mr. Eric Leonard West when I did a lot of complaining early on when he was you know, going out for school board, and he finally said, you know, Luciela, I'm really tired of you complaining. You need to put your money where your mouth is and do something about it. I go, dag nabbit, you're right. And so we've always been as involved as we can or could as parents. So we're committed. I mean, we need to be part of the solution. And we decided to stay as educated parents.
Jamaica, just a moment ago, you were talking about that when you are dealing with kids in urban environments who are telling you about the difficulties they face, that you come right back with things from your own experience that you've faced and sort of flip that script a little bit into like, yeah, that happened to me and I'm here now and I'm a person with this career and sitting here in front of you as a figure of authority, kind of, you know, and that you're able to relate to them and their experiences on a personal level. It makes so much sense that that would be beneficial to and make communication smoother and more effective in adult to kid interactions. But I mean, in terms of giving kids an understanding that authority can look a lot of different ways and that we also have to learn to negotiate difference with people who aren't like us. I mean, what is there value in having teachers who don't look like you?
Yes, I would never advocate that we have like in public school systems where the majority of the students are Black, have all Black teachers, or where the majority are Hispanic, have all mm-hmm. Hispanic teachers, because we don't live in a world where it's like that. No. I think we're on the opposite extreme right now. So there's an extreme of we have everyone who looks like you, or we have no one who looks like you. And I think we're closer to that extreme of no one who looks like you now. And I think that has to change. And I don't think it's just looking like you. It's even just background. I think a lot of times we talk about race when race is truly socioeconomic status as well. But it just so happens that people of color happen to be in the lower socioeconomic class more often than white people. And so I think that there needs to be a balance. You need to be able to see people who look like you doing this thing, who understand you, as well as have some folks who you mm-hmm. need to learn about.
Let's talk to Kimberly in Overland Park. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi. Thank you so much for this discussion on education. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Alrighty, thank you so much. I was telling your producer, answering the question that you had asked earlier about, did your teachers recognize you when you were young? And my parents moved to the Hickman Mills School District just for the school, took me out of private school, put me in a public elementary school, and I'm African American, and there were only 5 Black children in that whole elementary school, and no African-American teachers. Now, I don't think any teachers knew who I was or could relate to my parents, but it was a leap into the future of education success, and it was valuable, even though there were bumps along the way. But I now am raising my first grader in an Overland Park elementary school where she's the only African-American girl in 2 first grade classes, and there's 1 other African-American boy.
What is that like for you, and what is that like for her, to the best of your knowledge?
Well, at this young age, we, you know, love our classmates. I love the parents. I love the school, and I wouldn't trade it. But I think Jamaica had said that there's a running away from and a running to success. My parents have been very middle class my whole life, but I knew that I couldn't raise her in the now changed Hickman School District where I went to elementary school. And I had to move over to the Johnson County School District to get what I needed for her now, which I was getting in the 70s in Hickman Mills, but now it's all African-American.
I want to hear, thank you so much for that call from Jamaica Kendricks on this, because Jamaica, you do send your kids to public school, not in the Hickman Mills mm-hmm. district, but in Kansas City, Missouri.
I think as parents, we all try to make the best choices we can for our children to have the best futures possible. And so I don't expect for every parent to make the same choice that I did. And I don't fault people for making a different choice. But I do stick to the fact that you can get the education here, and a lot of us have. And I think her situation was different in that the demographics of her school district completely changed, and she moved her child to another school district that had similar demographics. But I can say, even with the transition in Kansas City Public Schools, and people say, you know, it's terrible there, why would you send your kids there? My son was originally in University Academy, and that's a charter school sponsored by UMKC, which is one of the highest performing. And I pulled him out of University Academy because I didn't agree with the attrition rate at that school, and decided to put him over at Central. And when I moved him to Kansas City Public Schools, of course, I thought, I'm going to have to put in more work to make sure that he's getting what I expect for him to get. And so the first paper that he turned in as a ninth grader at Central, I went over it. It was a one page, one paragraph paper. And I'm sitting here like, how in the world did you get to the point where you think that an entire paper could be one paragraph? He was also using language that he would use when talking to his friends in this paper. Well, at University Academy, he was passing in his English classes with a B. He performed proficient on English on the MAP standardized test, but he couldn't write. And he's a ninth grader. And at Pembroke, I would have never gotten away with that, even in middle school. And so I was very frustrated with that. And now at Central, he's doing much better. He has the attention he needs. And with my daughter, she's at Carver Dual Language, and she is three grade levels above where she needs to be in math, four in English, and she's fluent in Spanish and English. And that's from a Kansas City public school.
Man.
Central Standards off to one last break this morning. When we return, we'll wrap up this discussion about teaching across race, class, and culture before shifting our attention to change in the Northland. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've been talking about urban education with Usiel Pacina and Jamaica Kendricks. Now I'd like to bring Kyle Palmer in on the discussion. Kyle's a newscaster here at KCUR, but until this school year, he was a teacher. Kyle, what kind of classrooms did you teach in?
Well, I taught in a variety of classrooms. First of all, it's great to be here. Thank you very much. And an extremely interesting conversation as I've been listening off air. I taught in a variety of circumstances. I taught for 4 years in Houston, Texas, in a school in downtown Houston, which was at the time, I think 98 or 99% Latino. And then I moved to a charter school in California that was set up as its specific mission to be a student body that reflected the heterogeneity of the Redwood City community, which was in just south of San Francisco. So very racially and socioeconomically diverse, much more diverse than the student I was at the school that I was at in Houston. And then in another move, when I moved back with my wife to my home here in Kansas City, I worked in Independence. So that's where I've been at.
Kyle, I don't normally ask people to announce their racial identity, but since it's relevant to this discussion, what is your race?
I am white, Caucasian, non-Hispanic, if you go by the census forms and things like that.
So when you talk about teaching in schools with like 98% Latino student populations, do you think that affected your rapport with students?
Yes. I mean, frankly, when I went to that school in 2006, I was unprepared. And it was something that I had not thought about a lot, as I think a lot of white people would say when they get to be 18, 20, 22 years old, they don't think about race a lot because the greater society is geared towards their particular outlooks and perspectives a lot of times, not always. And so when I moved into that situation, a lot of my students had a very different worldview from me. And it was something that at the very beginning, I was not prepared to, at least academically and pedagogically, prepared to really meet their needs as well as I could have been.
Do you think that if there's one thing that you could have known before you went into those environments as a white teacher, what would it have been?
I think it would have been to have at the forefront of my mind that Black and brown students, just like white students, are individuals. They are their own people, and you cannot, I think, paint them with a broad brush and assume that they have these, you know, cultural characteristics that match your assumptions and your preconceived notions about how they're going to act or why they're acting a certain way or why they're not doing their homework. And really, just like the kids I grew up with, they were their own individual people.
Let's talk with Aaron in Kansas City. Very quickly, unfortunately, Aaron, what can you share?
Yeah. Well, you know, I just wanted to add a perspective. You know, I grew up in a very, very low income family. You know, only one parent was working at any given point. And so as soon as I was 16, you know, I had to go get a job. You know, if I wanted to attend school functions or go on school trips, you know, I had to pay for this. And so, you know, I'd get off school at 3, go to work at 4, work till midnight, go home, go to sleep, get up, go to school. You know, this was my week. And so a lot of times I would wind up dozing off in class. And so a lot of teachers would just assume that I was lazy or disengaged, mm-hmm. or that I just chose not to participate in class. And no one actually ever approached me to find out why it was I couldn't stay awake or why it was I didn't have this paper written. Instead, it was a write-up for insubordination or failure to complete the task.
Oh, this that discipline issue.
It sort of created a disengagement on top of their assumption, because it was a me versus them mentality at that point.
That happened to you, Aaron. And I want to get some reaction to this. Is that kind of ability to know what questions to ask part of how you are thinking about training teachers for urban environments?
Well, that begins in the beginning. It begins early on in your exposure to your class, getting to know your students from the get-go, getting to know the parents and finding out, you know, what are some unique things I should know about your child, since parents know their children absolutely so well. It's getting to know when you see your student falling asleep and, you know, hey, man, you usually don't do this. What's going on? What's happening? You know, and we asking questions, we getting to know our students and getting to know a little bit of their lives, not everything, but understanding, you know, there's some times where we're going to have to make some adjustments and have a greater understanding. Not lessening the expectations, but getting to know our students better.
My favorite teacher, Mr. Kyle, was a person we had in our family, a don't ask, don't tell issue. And my mom, we didn't talk about what was happening with my dad. And for some reason, Mr. Kyle called to talk about my brother who was having behavior issues. And my mom told him that my dad had just gone into a drug treatment center, and so we were dealing with those issues. And Mr. Kyle then, knowing that, was able to work with us differently and kind of understand my brother's behavior a little bit more. And so instead of putting him out of the classroom, he actually took time to take him aside and build a one-on-one relationship with him, mm-hmm. where he could motivate him to do things. And I think that's important with teachers, to be able to understand that. And I think that also comes from being a person who grew up experiencing kind of the same things. You kind of know what to look for and what to ask.
We have just a moment for the answer to this question, but what do you think of the new trend toward home visits for teachers?
I think it's wonderful. You all don't know this, but I was an alternative school principal, and I would often have to go do home visits myself and pick up students and bring them to school. I mean, it's a real good thing.
So, Usiel, you wanted to quickly say something to your son.
Yes, my son, Usiel Pacina Jr., has officially committed himself to service in the U.S. Army Reserve right before he goes off to college, so I want to congratulate him.
Usiel Pacina, Jamika Kendricks, and Kyle Palmer, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
That wraps up this morning's discussion on urban education, but feel free to continue talking about it on our Twitter feed. We're @KCURCST.